Stay tuned next for Resistance Roundtable here on WPKN in Bridgeport.
Good morning, and welcome to WPKN's Resistance Roundtable, coming to you the second Saturday of each month from 10 to 11 a.m. In this show, we talk about some of the breaking developments and resistance to the disasters and near disasters of the Trump administration with our regular panel, Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Scott Harris, and myself, Richard Hill. Ruth Ann teaches English at Central Connecticut State University and is active in the American Association of University Professors. She also directs plays for the Westport Community Theater, where her current production, Our Mother's Brief Affair, just opened for a two-week run. Scott Harris is host of Counterpoint, a public affairs show that airs on WPKN every Monday at 8 p.m., and he also is the executive producer of Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, a nationally syndicated show that also airs here on this station. And I host First Tuesday Rainy Day Radio, the Organic Farm Stand, and I'm also on the roster of hosts for the public issue show known as Mic Check, which airs every Sunday at 5:30 p.m. here on WPKN. This week we're going to be joined by two guests who will focus on the heightened political crisis in this country since the conclusion of the Senate sham trial of Donald Trump and this week's State of the Union address. First, we'll speak with Luke Savage, a journalist whose articles frequently appear in Jacobin magazine. And next, we'll talk with Dr. Jack Rasmus. He'll actually be returning. He was with us about a month ago. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College in California, and he'll speak about the current article of his in Counterpunch magazine, which assesses the content and effect of Wednesday's State of the Union address. So we have a full plate, a full menu today, but let's get started perhaps with some comments from our panel. Ruth Ann, would you kindly share your current obsession with us?
I would love to, as constantly obsessed. I've been thinking a lot about Romney's yes vote on the first article of impeachment. I'm also thinking of Martin Luther, directed at the Diet of Worms in 1521 to renounce the protests he had made against the Church of Rome. Reportedly, he said, "Here I stand, I can do nothing else. God help me. Hier stehe ich, ich kann nicht anders." Thrown out of the church. And Thomas More, as represented by playwright Robert Bolt in A Man for All Seasons, as he explains why he cannot, even on pain of death, sign the oath of succession Henry V wants. What is an oath, then, but words we say to God? When a man takes an oath, he's holding his own self in his own hands, like water, and if he opens his fingers then, he needn't hope to find himself again. Some men aren't capable of this, but I'd be loath to think your father one of them. If we lived in a state where virtue was profitable, common sense would make us good, and greed would make us saintly, and we'd live like animals or angels in the happy land that needs no heroes. But since, in fact, we see that avarice, anger, envy, pride, sloth, lust, and stupidity commonly profit far beyond humility, chastity, fortitude, justice, and thought, and have to choose to be human at all, why, then perhaps we must stand fast a little, even at the risk of becoming heroes. Perhaps this passage sticks in my mind so vividly because at Dickinson College I got to play Lady Alice More. I certainly had it in mind when at the University of Bridgeport I refused with my professional association and bargaining agent AAUP to sign a contract that we believed would have made it impossible for us to fulfill our responsibilities as academic professionals. For me, it was the end of a very satisfying and challenging career, and I knew it probably would be. For More, it was the end of his life, and he knew it. For Luther, it was the end of his participation in a church that had been his life and work, a church he was only trying to reform. And he knew it. And yesterday, Donald Trump started to lash out against those who put their loyalty to the country ahead of their loyalty to him. His latest target, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, the top Ukraine expert who testified before the House on the July 25th phone call, where Trump tried to extort an investigation into the Bidens from Ukrainian President Zelensky. He felt a sense of duty, he said, to tell the American people the truth. And he had told his father he had no worries about testifying in court because this is America, right matters. Yesterday, he was pushed out of his role at the National Security Council and escorted from the White House. As Common Cause has said, that honorable act has cost him his job, his career, and his privacy. For Mitt Romney, it will probably spell the end of his service as senator, unless the people of Utah rally behind him. It will certainly subject him to smears and slights from the person in the White House and from all those sycophants who have been aiding and abetting that person in his criminal and anti-patriotic pursuits. You could tell as he spoke that he knows this. With the Second Court of Appeals' refusal to hear the House case for a subpoena so they can investigate Trump's violation of the Emoluments Clause, they had no standing, the three judges ruled, because the request was filed in 2017 while Democrats were the minority party in the House. And a Supreme Court likely to turn five or six pairs of deaf ears to other challenges to Trump's notion of l'état c'est moi. I honor individuals of any party or rank who take a difficult stand by living up to the promises of the Constitution and their personal sense of integrity and obligation to something higher than themselves.
Thanks, Ruth. Interesting.
English prof.
Yeah, that was excellent. Scott Harris, what are your thoughts today?
Well, I've been ruminating about the impeachment trial, and though it was completely expected, it was a sham trial indeed, with no witnesses or documents permitted to be part of the process. And with few exceptions, as Ruth said, most Republican politicians and right-wing commentators endorsed Trump's corruption and his contemptible and immoral behavior. The most notable exception was former Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney. And as House Manager Adam Schiff, representative of California, said during the impeachment trial, history will not be kind to Donald Trump or the Republicans. But in my view, history will also not look approvingly on the Democrats in Congress and others who oppose Trump's corruption and lawbreaking if there isn't aggressive follow-up on investigating the president and the cronies who he surrounds himself with, who are involved in multiple scandals. In my view, the House must subpoena all those involved in the Ukraine extortion scandal, and that includes Vice President Mike Pence, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, former National Security Advisor John Bolton, Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney, resigned Energy Secretary Rick Perry, Trump's personal attorney Rudy Giuliani, and most egregious, I think, was White House counsel Pat Cipollone, who reportedly was in the room. And I should just go back and say Pat Cipollone was the lead defender, the attorney, the White House counsel defending Trump in the impeachment trial. But according to John Bolton, this guy who was talking about Trump's innocence in this trial was in the room when this whole shakedown of Ukraine was hatched. So, certainly integrity is not that guy's middle name. Also, California Representative Devin Nunes, the ranking GOP member of the House Intelligence Committee, another Trump crony, was allegedly involved, according to Bolton, in both the Ukraine shakedown scheme and the cover-up while co-chairing the House impeachment inquiry. Another guy without any integrity at all, and he should be prosecuted. Laws must be passed to prevent another future president from using the court system to evade justice by stonewalling legitimate congressional subpoenas for officials' testimony and documents, as happened in this whole episode. And you've got the White House in this case. Multiple court appeals were posted as soon as the House requested these documents and officials to testify. And it's going to take years to be adjudicated, but that's their plan. There has to be a fair and expedited system for court appeals in a situation like this that could easily be put in place by Congress, or I'm not sure how. Neither were any of the big bank and financial institutions, the Wall Street characters who plunged the economy into this horrible meltdown. None of them, not one, was prosecuted by Eric Holder, Obama's attorney general. If a Democrat's elected in 2020, we need to make sure that the rule of law is upheld, or we're going to have more presidents like Trump just thumbing their nose at the rule of law, and our country is going to devolve into a dictatorship, because that's what this whole impeachment episode set up, which means that the president is above the law. And if that's maintained, we're in big trouble.
I think you're right on the money. We're in dire straits here, and I think it's become a cliche to say that our nation is at a very dangerous moment. But let me just say, we are at a very dangerous moment. We are going to be speaking about the post-impeachment and post-Sotu address landscape with our guests today, but it can't be overstated how volatile Trump and his congressional cult members are as we sprint toward the November election. Nor should we pull any punches when describing what took place in the mock trial. It was no less than a criminal conspiracy between Mitch McConnell, the Senate Republicans, and Donald Trump to corrupt the impeachment trial in the Senate. As McConnell confessed, interestingly, before he committed the crime, quoting, "Everything I do during this, I'm coordinating with the White House counsel. There will be no difference between the president's position and our position as to how to handle this." Now the corporate media, although oftentimes you might say corrupt media, are describing this as a big win for Trump. They're kind of observing with ill-concealed admiration that he has had a great week and that he is enjoying his victory lap as the Democrats sort of stumble through the first couple of primaries. So what does this big winner do in the afterglow of his victory? Well, while we were sleeping or staring bleary-eyed at the tragic farce that unfolded in the well of the Senate over the past 2 weeks, our government just moved the Armageddon clock closer to midnight by deploying a low-yield nuke on a U.S. Navy submarine. As the Washington Post blandly reported, the U.S. Defense Department said on Tuesday the Navy had fielded, to use a sports analogy, very comforting, a low-yield submarine-launched ballistic missile warhead, something the Pentagon believes is needed to deter adversaries like Russia, but which critics say lowers the threshold for using nuclear weapons. What's the reason behind this? Well, in the words of William Arkin, who was on Democracy Now! Yesterday, he says, "What this weapon is about is having a more usable nuclear weapon against countries like Iran and North Korea." Mm-hmm. He goes on to say that at this very moment, when U.S.-Iranian relations are at such a deep divide, and at a time when Iran is now free to continue to pursue the development of nuclear materials and possibly nuclear weapons, I think we may now see the beginning of the creation of an argument that Iran is developing weapons of mass destruction and that the United States is going to have to take action against that. These new low-yield nuclear weapons are the perfect little pinpricks that could bring down, actually destroy a country, bring it to its knees. This is probably the strategy behind this whole new deployment. Meanwhile, we've learned from various news reports that while this has all been going on, posters from 4chan, which is the anonymous message board famous as a gathering spot for trolls, shared the phone number of Iowa's Democratic caucus results line on Monday evening and encouraged readers to clog the lines. This was reported in many news services. Well, they clearly succeeded, and that debacle in Iowa was the result of dirty tricks, starting already, not even during the actual election. So what we're now contending with is an enraged Trump fighting for his political life as well as his freedom, because if he doesn't get reelected, he's going to be in the dock somewhere, and willing to use any tactic to win, voter suppression in its many forms. And according to McKay Coppins in The Atlantic, his article came out the past few days, a finely calibrated social media campaign to send targeted Facebook misinformation to individual voters, not unlike Cambridge Analytica. Mm-hmm. Actually, the Trump campaign claims to have 3,000 data points on every voter in the nation. And they are making, just as Cambridge Analytica did with their 150 million targets, they're making the case in very tailored fashions to voters all over the country with all kinds of blatant lies. My rant is run its course.
Well, we have our first guest on the line here on Resistance Roundtable this morning. I'd like to welcome to the program Luke Savage. Luke is a writer based in Toronto, Canada, and a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine. As an undergraduate, he was editor-in-chief of Canada's largest student newspaper and has since worked as a political staffer at Queen's Park and for a federal member of parliament. Luke was a candidate himself for the Ontario New Democratic Party in the 2014 provincial election. And he writes about Canadian and international politics, religion, labor issues, philosophy, and the history of the Democratic left. His writing has appeared in The Guardian, Canada Land, and The New Statesman, The Tyee, Current Affairs, and other publications. He also co-hosts a weekly podcast about current events, Agitprop Cinema. Luke, thank you so much for making time to be on our show this morning. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I think that's the most comprehensive introduction I've ever had, so it's appreciated.
Okay, mark that on your calendar. Luke, thank you for sharing your perspective on the impeachment as we start off on our conversation here from our neighbor to the north. As a political writer and observer of politics, what do you come away with from what many of us believe was a utter sham of a trial in the U.S. Senate, a virtual cover-up, as many of us here in the country believe it was? What are some of your observations about the aftermath of the impeachment trial?
I think my interpretation of the events surrounding impeachment might be a little different than, I mean, it certainly differs from kind of the, you know, mainstream liberal interpretation in that, you know, I haven't actually been following kind of the nuts and bolts drama of the trial as much as other people, because it seemed to me that the whole way along, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion. It's not that I don't also think Trump's, you know, criminality is itself a foregone conclusion. Of course it is. But I think the particular manner in which the Democratic Party chose to prosecute the impeachment proceedings, the, you know, narrow focus on, you know, collusion and, you know, this issue of in the Ukraine, I think that actually kind of impeded what could have been a very different kind of prosecution, one that, you know, cast a much larger net and would have been harder for Trump to get away from. Then again, given that there is a Republican majority in the Senate, it does seem like the impeachment trial, quite possibly in any form, was going to lead to the same outcome in terms of Trump's acquittal. I'm not sure it necessarily needed to lead to the same outcome in terms of his approval ratings, reportedly now being, I think, possibly their highest ever. The Democrats here have potentially handed Donald Trump a re-election tool, and I'm not sure that was necessary. But in general, I think that the impeachment trial, you know, because the result was a foregone conclusion, it's become a sort of, you know, it became a sort of spectacle for the Democratic base on one side, who could, you know, listen to Adam Schiff and enjoy the spectacle of him prosecuting the case, for the Republican base, you know, watching Trump's lawyers defend the president, etc. You know, it kind of became a political proxy battle instead of a legal process, as Ozita Nwenebu pointed out in a really good piece in the New Republic recently. So I think those are my general thoughts. People should be focused on the political outcome, which, for the time being, is that you know, is a win for Trump, regardless of you know, what his guilt may be, and indeed probably is.
So we have our panelists here, co-hosts Ruth Ann Baumgartner and Richard Hill. Either of you have something to ask?
It's Ruth Ann Baumgartner. I would have loved to have a third article of impeachment that addressed the emoluments clause, but the Court of Appeals for Washington or wherever it was yesterday has roundly rejected the possibility of the first subpoena that would have supported such a charge on the grounds that it was filed while the Democrats were in the minority in the House. I wonder how you feel about turning to the law for any kind of support in turning to the courts for any kind of support in the kind of situation we find ourselves in.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good question. And the piece I just cited in the New Republic, had a sentence that's really stuck with me, which is that from the moment Trump took office, a particularly plugged-in segment of the Democratic electorate has been waiting for a Boy Scout with a law degree to take him down. And I think this is a really important point. There is a tremendous lust, really, for a non-electoral solution to Trump and to Trumpism. This goes back to 2016, through the Mueller investigation, through, kind of the Russiagate. But even, I think, all the way back to the 2016 election itself, where there was this just kind of hope that the system, U.S. institutions broadly defined, electoral, media, political, and otherwise, we're just going to kind of put a stop to this because this wasn't, this wouldn't do. This was, outside of the bounds of convention and all the rest of it. And we've seen again and again how that is not adequate in the face of the particular threat posed by Trumpism. There needs to be a political political solution, and there needs to be an ideological challenge, in my view, because the particular institutions of law and Congress in the United States, I don't think are going to stop Donald Trump.
Well, Luke, it does seem that the institutions of government, the processes by which a president could be tried and impeached, have been smashed to smithereens by this last debacle that occurred in the Senate. So I'm wondering, as we go forward, and you mentioned the political solution, obviously, the election is coming up not too far down the road. How do you see the possible tactics or strategies that could be employed by the candidates now? What are the prospects, let's say, for a candidate balancing the anti-Trump approach with their own highly developed or finely tuned policy plans for attracting new voters to get involved in the 2020 election?
Well, I think there's two things to consider here. One is who is going to be, which among the Democratic candidates, who among them is going to have vulnerabilities that are easy for Trump to exploit. That's one thing. And the other is who has a strategy for, as you alluded to, increasing turnout and winning key states that were kind of the linchpins of Trump's Electoral College victory in 2016. So states like Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin, for example. To me, there's really only one answer to this question. I mean, I think that Bernie Sanders is the only Democratic candidate who has, who both is not going to be vulnerable to, I mean, this is maybe a bit of a generalization, but not going to be vulnerable to, kinds of charges that, for example, would be directed at Joe Biden around, his son, which, that is potentially the Hillary Clinton's email server scandal of this election. I think it would be much more sensible to nominate somebody without that kind of baggage. To carry on the theme of Biden, he also has this, 40 years or so of votes and things like that on trade deals and all kinds of other things Trump would exploit. The same goes with several of the other Democratic candidates. Pete Buttigieg. It's very hard for me to imagine him defeating Trump in a general election. But that's one thing, the vulnerabilities. And then the second is how do you increase turnout? And again, the only answer, it seems to me, is with a popular program that deals structurally with the social causes, to put it a bit crudely, of of Trumpism, and you know, is able to motivate people, get them involved in the political process in a way that they haven't been before. And I mean, Sanders, you know, it's kind of still early, but there's, you know, his movement has I think already proven that it's something quite unique. You know, it's out fundraising candidates that are meeting billionaires in wine caves, which really is no small thing. And so I think that's the kind of, you know, I think without, you know, populist dynamism, Donald Trump might be able to cruise to re-election. You know, he's going to be able to talk about, you know, his economic performance. He's going to, you know, he's going to be able to talk about how the Democrats tried to take him out with this bogus impeachment process. You know, he's going to be able to talk about how to trade deals that ruined, you know, ruined the Midwest and how he's just negotiated a better one, et cetera, et cetera. And so I don't think the sort of conventional tools that Democrats have deployed against past Republican candidates will work against Trump. And again, since 2016, I mean, since the initial Democratic response to Trump, you've seen, I think, the same kind of suite of tools pulled out over and over again. Apart from Sanders in varying degrees, I think most or much of the Democratic field is sort of attempting to draw from that suite of tools. And I think that's potentially a very serious mistake.
We're speaking with Luke Savage, a writer based in Toronto, Canada, and a staff writer at Jacobin Magazine, here on Resistance Roundtable. I'm Scott Harris, here with co-hosts Ruth Ann Baumgartner and Richard Hill. And Luke, I did have a question for you, and it relates to a recent article you wrote that's titled, "The Stop Sanders Movement is Worried That Bernie Can Actually Win, Not That He'll Lose." And you note that there is a panic among the establishment corporate Democrats and their corporate funders that Bernie's got a lot of momentum, and with his, you know, near win, actual win, when you take a look at the raw votes in Iowa, and he may be headed to victory in New Hampshire, that folks in this Democratic corporate world are pulling out of the stops, hoping Bloomberg or somebody else can be the standard bearer for moderate Democrats, quote unquote. And I'm wondering how you view their project right now, if it can succeed. And on the other hand, I did want to ask you about all the warnings that people in the U.S. media are issuing about how disastrous a Bernie Sanders candidacy would be, because he'll be red-baited as a socialist, as a communist. I heard Chris Matthews on MSNBC last night basically saying that he's not sure whether Bernie Sanders is down with Castro and Soviet communism. It was absurd. But that's that's a guy who's a quote-unquote democratic kind of center-left commentator on a, you know, liberal network. But this is going to be pulled out with lots of money behind it. Corporate America is going to pull out all the stops in funding a campaign to smear Bernie Sanders as an existential threat to American capitalism and the country and everyone in it. I don't know. What's some of your response to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, so the particular article of mine that you mentioned, you know, I've written a number of things in this vein recently, and that one, you know, I think the main point I was trying to emphasize is that oftentimes when you read these articles in, you know, places like The Hill, or, you know, you see them on Twitter, you know, they've been published pretty widely, you know, warning that Bernie Sanders can't win, you know, often, or sometimes just reporting on, you know, well, people are saying Bernie Sanders can't win. I think there was one in Politico the week I wrote that I was responding to. You know, they'll often cite people who are called things like Democratic operative, Democratic strategist, or something. But oftentimes, when you look into the backgrounds of these people, you know, they actually have clients, you know, through consultancies and things like that, who would be, you know, have an immediate pecuniary interest in not having a Bernie Sanders presidency. They would be hurt by his policy program, you know, or the people that donate to their, you know, think tanks or whatever would be hurt by his policy program. You know, if you're a health insurance company and you donate to centrist think tanks, you know, you're doing it because you're hoping they will lobby the public and the Democratic Party away from, you know, a single-payer model. And there are innumerable other examples in the same vein. That's one thing to keep in mind about this Bernie Sanders can't win stuff is what a lot of it is actually saying is we don't want Bernie Sanders to win, which isn't, you know, it's quite a different sentiment than he can't win. You know, so that's one thing. You know, I guess to get to kind of the second part of your question, I mean, I do think that if Bernie Sanders is the Democratic nominee, and I'm getting to a point where I think he probably will be, the U.S. media and the kind of American political class, broadly defined, is going to undertake a meltdown that is going to be unlike anything we've ever seen. I think it will exceed the 2016 freakout over Donald Trump. I saw the Chris Matthews segment that you alluded to a few moments ago last night, and I think that is really a taste of things to come. I mean, just the most absurd kind of on-air tantrum, one of the silliest of its kind I've ever seen on cable news. Not that I watch a lot of cable news, but, you know, there's going to be more stuff like that in the same vein. Whether that hurts Bernie Sanders, I think, is an open question. I think organized corporate money will certainly resist him. I mean, that is kind of what the Michael Bloomberg candidacy, such as it is already about. You know, the Sanders theory of change is that they have a strategy to deal with that, which is, you know, popular mobilization, using social media to kind of get around that stuff. You know, I don't think it's an accident that Sanders does so much better with demographics who don't tend to watch a lot of cable news. You know, cable news will probably be uniformly hostile. You know, that's the kind of strategy to deal with that stuff. And I think potentially things like the Chris Matthews rant will, you know, help rather than hurt Sanders. I mean, did it help rather than hurt Donald Trump, you know, who was... I mean, I'll crudely call him a populist outsider with some asterisks, you know, attached to that that phrase. But I mean, the entire U.S. media virtually was trying to cancel Donald Trump every single day of, you know, 2015 and 2016, and it didn't work. You know, it didn't work. I think the power of things like cable news is real, but I think it can be overstated, and I don't think the kind of, you know, mainstream American media or the mainstream kind of party leaderships, Democratic or Republican, are these kind of all-powerful entities. I think that they, you know, if you look at polling, it's just, you know, a very, very kind of straightforward way of looking at it. All of these things are kind of unpopular. They don't have tremendous popular support, and so when candidates kind of run afoul of them, it's not necessarily a death sentence, and I think that will be true of Bernie Sanders as well.
I certainly hope so. I do feel, though, that given that the United States population has been marinated in anti-communism for 100 years now, the very word communism and socialism, and by the way, Trump used the word in an interview with Sean Hannity the other day. Bernie Sanders, he's a communist, you know, and he skipped right over socialists and went right to communist. So, I mean, it's hard for me, somebody who lived through the Cold War and a bit of the McCarthy period, to imagine that this is not going to be wielded as a very, very brutal and effective weapon against a candidate. And I worry about it. So I wanted to mention that we are going to move on to our next interview now. And we want to thank you so much, Luke Savage, for joining us today. Thank you very much. Please be ready for another call from us to have you back for more commentary.
Anytime, guys. This is a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Luke.
Bye-bye.
So right now we have Jack Rasmus on the line. Jack is a professor of economics at St. Mary's College in California. He's the host of the weekly radio show Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network. He's the author of numerous books and articles on economics and politics, including his just released book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. Jack blogs at jackrasmus.com. And his website for all his other writings can be found at jackrasmusproductions.com. Dr. Rasmus, thanks so much for joining us on Resistance Roundtable.
Glad to be here.
Thanks so much.
So, Jack, this is Richard Hill. I wanted to, I know your article, which was recently in ZNet and also is now in counterpunch.org, really narrates almost blow by blow the State of the Union address and talks about the kind of toxic fumes that come off of each section and each gambit that Trump used in that address. Could you give us perhaps a brief summary of some of the key points, the key danger spots that you saw there, and what the ramifications are for the political climate as we move from there into a very heated, overheated political season?
Yeah, well, the first thing to understand was that this was not a normal State of the Union address. This was an agitational speech to his political base. That's why I entitled it Trump Throws Red Meat Speech to His Base. A couple things that are very interesting, apart from the fact that it is an agitational speech, I won't get into describing, unless you want me to, what are the elements of an agitational speech, but it follows those classic elements very, very closely. You know, a couple of the highlights of this speech is that, you know, once again, it's he's doubling down on a racist theme, but it's got a twist here. The racist theme, of course, is Latinos, people of color, especially Latinos coming from the border, right, are the criminal. The immigrant is the criminal. You know, that's the blaming it on, you know, the outsider always. It's a classic theme of ultranationalism and proto-fascism, he's well now within that tradition. But he expanded this theme by really going after sanctuary cities, which means now, you know, he's really going to target California, sanctuary state, you're going to see a lot of California bashing coming out very soon. He even proposed legislation so individuals could sue California, you know, tie California up in all these legal suits, and use it as a way of mobilizing his base. You know, it reminds me of years past when right wingers have done the same thing with abortion clinics, right? And agitated the base to go after the clinics, and even attack doctors and nurses and so forth. This sanctuary cities thing is going to play the same role. You know, when you have the enemy, and the enemy is within us, another classic agitational element here, that, you know, anybody who defends them, whether it's individuals or Democratic Party or whomever, are by nature or by definition also the enemy within the fifth column or whatever it is that you got to deal with here as well. So he's setting up the Democrats for direct attacks as well. But his racist theme has an interesting split here in this speech. And that is, he's clearly making an overture to black Americans, African Americans here. He's the racist, very clear racist president here, as far as blacks are concerned, is now trying to look like the defender and sort of, you know, pull them away from the Democratic Party. And, you know, the party has a long-standing a relationship with all minority groups. Well, he's trying to split the minority groups. Latinos and Muslims are still, you know, evil and the enemy. But the blacks now he's going to appeal to. And this was launched in the speech. You could see it with what I call gallery melodrama, which is taking the new heights in this latest speech. This is where you introduce people up in the gallery that you've assaulted up there on purpose, and the cameras turn to them, and it's a very emotional, using theme, you know, tug on the heartstrings here to make a political point, an emotional appeal. And we had several of those. You know, we had the young girl with her mother who was trying to get into a private school, and he announces a scholarship for her. Right there. He's the savior. Mm. And at the same time, he gets the knock public education, which is his way of upping vouchers and school prayer. Mm. Then they have another young boy wants to be an astronaut. And sitting right next to him is his veteran grandpa in uniform here. And Trump announces that he's going to, he just made him a brigadier general. You know, then we cut to the Joint Chiefs of Staff sitting there on the floor in the chamber clapping for it. We have another appeal. And he talks about more money for black colleges. And this goes back. He actually launches this new racist strategy here, splitting minority vote, during the Super Bowl. Remember that ad there? You recall that where he takes playing for the criminal reform. It's a young, not a young, but an elderly black woman there, and she's so thankful that her relative finally got released, so forth. There's a real effort here to create a new image for him with black Americans. Why? Because he's using it as a margin in the swing states and even some southern states, you know, where blacks have been organizing fairly effectively, like in Georgia. He's trying to give himself a margin of victory in the election here and make sure those states, particularly swing states, will be safe for him because he's going to lose some votes to white suburban women in those states, and he knows it. So his strategy is this new split racism. But then there's a lot of other throwing red meat and bones to his base there, supporting gun rights once again, school prayer, scholarships for blacks, Educational Freedom Scholarship Act, which is designed to undermine public schools. Time and time again, he throws the bones, you know. What's missing is a typical speech here for presidential State of the Union, where the president typically says, okay, I've done this, and then points to where he's going. You know, what you get where he's going here is we're going after Latinos, we're going after California, we're going after schools and school prayer, all the other typical gun rights and so forth. He doesn't say much about trade, you know. Typically, he's been bloating about trade in his trade deals. You think he would have said something about that, but he just sort of mentions them, and he glosses right over. There's not much to mention for those trade deals, really. The NAFTA 2.0, there's really nothing there that's much changed. And the China deal, it's all about China, as he said, buying $100 billion more of goods from the U.S. Well, that's an outright lie, because the Chinese have never agreed to that. And all the estimates now are it's going to be well less than $50 billion a year, well less. So I guess he didn't want to talk about that much, and nothing about where he's going with trade next. The same with taxes. Usually Republicans talk about taxes. Well, I guess he didn't want to mention this $4 trillion tax cut of 2018 and the effect that it's had on the economy, which is just about nil, because what you get here last year was a nine-month collapse of real investment by business, and that was tax cuts were supposed to stimulate investment and therefore jobs. Well, it had just the opposite effect. And, of course, he didn't say anything about how he just passed through rule changes, another $427 billion in loopholes for his friends, and how he's going after making the $5 trillion tax cuts permanent and indexed. You know, so nothing about taxes, nothing about hardly anything about trade, nothing about the deficit that's now over $1 trillion because of the tax cuts and defense spending. He talks about family leave, like he's a champion of family leave, but if you look at his family leave proposal, paid family leave, in other words. It's only if you have kids 6 years old or under. Right? Nothing for family illness. And the worst thing about this family leave proposal is that you got to pay it back. You know, there's nothing really coming from the government to pay when you're, you know, taxed like unemployment insurance or something when you're not able to work for family crises purposes. No, you may get paid family leave, but then you got to pay the employer back. Nothing about Social Security and Medicare, except he said he would defend it even when a week earlier, when he's at a week or two earlier, when he's at Davos, Switzerland with the billionaires, he was asked what he's going to do about the deficit and Social Security, and he said, let it slip, he's going after Social Security right after the election.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing about details again about the Space Force, which is going to cost us hundreds of billions of dollars. Nothing about foreign policy, except to claim that, you know, the U.S., he destroyed ISIS, which isn't true. It was really the Kurds and the Russians and the Iranians that did it. Of course, nothing about Iran, except another threat. You know, his foreign policy has been a total failure. Whether you look at, you know, ISIS or Syria or Venezuela, where he had an attempted coup that didn't make it, or Iran, where we almost went to war with Iran. It's been a, or this most recent Israeli-Palestinian deal, which is a dead on arrival, right? So foreign policy was a total fiasco under this guy. And then we have all the typical lies that he's been putting out for quite some time, like GDP, right? Well, he says we have the best economy in history. Well, GDP, average GDP, is no different than it was under Obama. It's the same GDP. And as far as jobs are concerned, you know, he claims there's 6.4 million jobs. Well, the last 3 years under Obama, it was over 8 million. So it's 1.7 million short after we give business and corporations a $4 trillion tax cut. And, of course, the wages are just not true. There's been surveys by Bankrate and others that show that over half of Americans got no raise whatsoever in the last 2 years, in each of the last 2 years. How can you have 3% wage growth when over half of the labor force got absolutely nothing? Well, the way you get that is that, you know, those at the very top get the wage increase, or you only count full-time employees on an average, right? And you don't adjust it for inflation. Well, when you adjust for inflation and you count the 60 million part-time and temp, well, there's no wage increase, not 3%. But yet he goes and he claims that families are flourishing, even though like two-thirds don't have more than $400 to their name in case of emergency, causes a blue-collar boom, says he'll protect pre-existing conditions in healthcare when he's done, made proposals quite to the contrary, claims a 16% low wage increase when that was really due to some of the blue states raising the minimum wage. So we got all the lies that we typically get from this guy, repeating all of those lies, and we get throwing red meat to the base, and we get a new racism, and we really don't get much of a picture of where things are going. And, you know, some typical Republican themes are totally ignored because they're not Republican anymore. They're Trump-publican. This guy has totally transformed his political party, and it's really a sycophant following here. And now we got the same thing in the Senate. So he brags about, you know, he appointed 187 federal judges. He had two Supreme Court judges. But now he's got the Supreme Court in his back pocket. He's got a mobilized base that threatens any moderate Republican, drives them out of the party. And he's got a puppy puppet there in Mitch McConnell and the control of the Senate. And, you know, now you got Bill Barr, an attorney general, really spouting this theory that which tells you where they're coming from, that you can't charge a president or convict the president of anything while he's in office. Of anything. Well, that means he's a dictator when he's in office, and it means he's above the law when he's in office, which is the definition classical of a tyrant. We got a tyrant and a guy who is increasingly going to govern by himself, right? That's the definition of a dictator. And you can see it in his total attempt to isolate Congress. Well, he's got the Senate, but they'll isolate and govern without the House of Representatives. And that's where this guy's going. He's going to govern more by executive order. He's going to govern more by moving the money allocated by the House to whatever pet project he wants, which, of course, is the wall. He's already begun that. He's going to govern by national emergencies declaration. And, of course, he governs internationally here with sanctions and tariffs.
Dr. Rasmus?
Yeah.
We only have a few minutes.
That's pretty much what I got to say.
Good.
Well said.
Excellent summary of the speech and the Trump in this election year. Just had a quick question here. We only have a few minutes left. The conventional wisdom is that 15% of the electorate in the United States in the coming election is up for grabs. Don't know if that's accurate or not, but I wanted to get your take on how the Democrats respond to what you just laid out, which is the strategy of Trump and the Republicans to maintain control of the White House and Senate. What's the best approach? Should it be attacking Trump's weaknesses and his failures that you outlined, or is it to outline some new programs and policies that challenge the status quo, and really aim to inspire people to go to the polls by breaking down what's wrong and trying to rebuild it with some real changes to the structure of the U.S. economy?
Yeah, well, you know, the strategy of the Democratic Party leadership, and you got to understand that party is really split. Just like Trump split the Republicans and took it over, you got an internal catfight going on within the Democratic Party. You have the corporate moneybag wings, the DLC, Democratic Leadership Conference faction that took over that party in the 80s under Clinton, fighting to maintain control of that, and their strategy is represented in Biden, and the strategy is what they thought they had here in the midterms, and that is to pick up votes in the swing constituencies, right? The suburban, exurban, veterans and soccer moms and so forth. That's their strategy. It's not going to work in the national election. Plus, they are pretty much negating their effect by doing everything they can, and we see it emerging now, the scuttling Sanders, the one candidate who is trying to focus on some new initiatives, some new ideas, because the only way the Democrats can really win is to really mobilize and get people out to vote who hadn't gotten out to vote. And even then, it's going to be difficult because it's pretty clear he's got most of the red states locked up. And, of course, that's due to gerrymandering and voter suppression and so forth. And the Democrats have not been able to stop that. Obama let that happen and didn't do much about it, and now they're paying the price. So he's got a lot of the red state strategy, Trump does, locked up. And that's been the strategy of Republican right for a long time. And it's going to be hard to pull out, some of those swing states, particularly if you've got a guy like Sleepy Joe. Donald Trump will eat him alive. And the Democrats say, oh, you can't go with a Sanders because Sanders can't win. Well, Joe Biden can't win. That's for damn sure. And what they're doing is trying to split the vote in the primaries, keep as many candidates out there. And there's a lot of big money, like behind Buttigieg now, a lot of hedge funds and so forth, giving them a lot of exposure. And you're going to see the same thing with Klobuchar now. And, of course, they want to keep Warren in the race. All of that's designed, I believe, to prevent Sanders from getting a first ballot Democratic convention primary candidate win. The way the rules are now in the Democratic Party, these, I don't know, 600-700 special delegates will not vote on the first ballot. And the idea is to prevent Sanders from winning on the first ballot, to release the Kraken of these monster of these special delegates to put whomever the Democrats want in the candidate seat. So, I believe their candidate now is Bloomberg. And it's all designed for Bloomberg to win at the convention and prevent Sanders from winning. And you can see it. They're coming out everywhere. You know, Obama's coming out. Hillary's coming out.
Jack,
all of them.
We're flat out of time, but I want to thank you very much, Jack Rasmus, Dr. Jack Rasmus, who is a professor of economics at St. Mary's College in California. Thanks for coming back and doing another round with us here at the Resistance Roundtable.